Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 19 of the Create More podcast with me, Ben Stewart. And this fortnight's is with Kibwe Tavares from Factory 15. No, do you know what I'm going to tell you? You should go on Vimeo and type in Factory 15, and you should go and watch two amazing videos that Kibwe has directed. He's one of the co-founders of Factory 15, and I've always been really, really interested in the visual side of Factory 15, and we work together on projects inside of Make. They do a lot of architectural visualizations for us, and they're stunning. And Kibwe has... He's kind of been there. He does a lot of the directing for the kind of short films that they've done, and over the years these films have become more and more ambitious. And yeah, go on Vimeo, and Kibwe's just finished an amazing Guinness advert. It's an Africa special called Alive Inside. Go and watch it, because it's so good. It's got so much energy, and the colours are amazing, the visuals are amazing, and just it's got these amazing dancers. And I think he said it's filmed in Ghana, and they flew in amazing dancers from all over the world, and it's in like these really like rundown parts. And yeah, it's very much it seems to be in keeping with kind of Kibwe's directing style, which is it's kind of got this like rebellious streak to it, which is really, really good. So you should watch the Guinness Africa special Alive Inside. And also he did a short film he talks about in the podcast along with Film 4 called Jonah. It's all about this giant fish that transforms this this town, and again, visual style is amazing, and it's so much imagination in it. I think that's what's amazing. And he studied at the Bartlett. He did his part one. He did his part two at the Bartlett, an architecture degree for those non-architects listening. And then he did an amazing short called Robots of Brixton, and it ended up winning him the RABA Silver Award, which is like a student's medal. And it's really, really good, which you should also watch on YouTube. And then since then, he's kind of gone on to bigger and bigger things. And they've just done a short called Anna, A-N-A. And it's about this like it's about this kind of menacing robot with a kind of a famous actor in that I'm sure you'd recognise. And the robot kind of takes over. It's like an AI and takes over this like futuristic car factory. Really, really high concept, but I mean, when you watch it, remember this is like I think all of Factory 15, they're all under 30. I think there's 12 of them at the moment, and I'm pretty sure they do all the in-house effects themselves. So Kibwe directs, and they come up with all the concept art, and I think they do all of it in-house as long with their architectural stuff. They're just a very, very, very cool practice. So you should definitely check out those videos, and we talk about all, you know, how he got into doing it, and it's a really, really interesting podcast. So hope you enjoy. Listen in the end to find out who's on next Fortnite's podcast. Enjoy. Bye-bye.
I was interviewing someone last night. He's like he's a computer game designer.
Yep.
No, he's an artist. I'm not allowed to say computer game designer. He does the concept art.
Yeah.
And he's like also my friend.
Right.
We just in here and had like a few beers and then ended up interviewing for 2.5 hours. That won't happen this time. I actually have a time restraint this time. But thank you. I'm joined by Kibwe, and I can't pronounce your second name.
Tavares,
there you go. From Factory 15.
Yes.
And I obviously wanted to get you guys in because... Originally, when I started the podcast, it was all about creative storytelling. I like Assemble Studios, one of the first ones I had, and they were like, I loved the style of the stuff they did. And going when we worked together, or we worked together, Matt, on our project, seeing all your kind of architectural visualizations. And then I found out that you did Robots of Brixton, which I loved, and then found out more about Studio. So I really wanted to get you in to kind of firstly talk to you about kind of, you know, how you started, because you started as an architecture degree, right? And then kind of go on to kind of, you know, like using Unreal and all the stuff you've done at the studio. So why don't we just start by, why don't you explain what Factory 15 is to people who...
Oh, yeah.
give us the spiel.
It changes every time. We're essentially kind of a design and animation studio. We're based out of Brixton, but we're moving soon. We started about 5 years ago. So our main focus is kind of, I guess we've got this kind of quite cheesy line on our website, which is like a design-led approach to filmmaking, and a, I can't even remember it. But essentially, kind of our films are kind of quite heavily designed.
Yeah.
But essentially, we tell stories, and we tell them through design, and we do stuff digitally.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I loved. I mean, I guess you've got quite a diverse range of people at the studio, right? Because you do the film side of stuff,
right?
And then you also do architectural stills and visualizations. What else do you guys do, or is that kind of the?
So essentially, we do films, we do some commercial stuff, and we do stuff for architects. But our focus, we've basically set it up so we can kind of work in all these different streams, because what we found out is that our work is kind of relevant for all these different industries. And the way we try and kind of keep it consolidated is that everything has to be in some way spatial, in some way about space or the built environment. So that means you can do an advert, or you can do a film, or you can do kind of a straight piece of kind of like architectural representation, as opposed to kind of saying we only make films, because when we started we didn't exactly know where it was going to go, how we're going to get kind of paid to do it, how we're going to get jobs. We kind of just launched in and said, look, we know we like making these kind of weird, odd architectural films, and let's just try keep making them. And surprisingly, we managed to get commissioned to do some more stuff. So
surprisingly, despite our best efforts,
we're still going. So that's good.
Because correct me if I'm wrong, you have a kind of, I feel like a bit of a like a house style, but it's kind of, especially the earlier stuff, is a bit like dystopian, is
dystopia.
That the word? Dystopia, which is amazing, because it gives you a very rich kind of visual style. And I remember coming to your office, and you had this, like, it looked like a rundown version of London. And it was awesome. And I kind of think it's always had quite a film feel to a lot of your work. Is that always been something that you've tried to do, kind of conceptual?
I think from our, when we studied together, Nick Clear was our, he was our lead tutor, Nick Clear and Simon Kennedy. And Nick would always kind of, you present your idea, you'd say, this is an architecture school, this is what I want to make, I kind of want it. And then he would always kind of pick out the weird, rundown kind of shit bit of your presentation, and then he would almost push you, not necessarily on purpose, just through what his taste is, to that. So I do think there was a kind of a dystopic thing that kind of came from us all working together and being in that space at the Bartlett.
And so this is the Bartlett. Are you all from the Bartlett then?
Me, Jono and Paula, and there's a group of us that set it up, and then actually Matt, who's kind of was our first employee, came from Oxford Brookes, and then we do have some Bartlett people. We've got a mix of people now. Not everyone's an architecture student. We've got a mix of a whole bunch of people. We're 12 people now. So, but initially, when we set out, we all done our part two at the Bartlett.
So you're 12 people now.
12, full time.
When you were, because a lot of the podcast is about like startups as well. And I realized, like, I say startup, but you know what I mean, running your own practice. Like, when you started, were you like, I don't want to employ other people, I just want to do my own work? Or were you always like, no, we need to grow in size, I want to do more complicated stuff, that inherently means having more people? Or
I don't think we really knew. We knew that we wanted to keep making projects, and as projects, you know, got bigger, we needed more people to do them. So it's kind of been fairly organic and been fairly steady. So I'd probably say we've probably grown an average of 2 people a year.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so But you still freak out about the wage bill. You still freak out about your overheads. You still freak out about all that sort of stuff that you did at the very start. It's just the numbers get bigger.
Because, like, the monthly wage bill must just be like, just, I'm not going to think about it. I'm just not going to think about it. The money will come in. Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Basically, that's what it's like. But, you know, it's been okay so far. And we try and make the right decisions, and we try and kind of talk about things a lot and work out what the right jobs to take are, like what the right jobs to go for are, how we kind of keep the identity of the work, but keep the scale of the projects, but increase the scale of the projects, how you do smaller projects, which you could do when you were a smaller team easily. You know, when you start having more people, it's harder to kind of take those things on, but they're also the more interesting projects.
Because you've, because when I went down there, your office is in Brixton.
Yeah.
Because it's like a, is it a university block or university building? There's loads. There's loads of open studios.
Yeah. So it's like an artist studio. So we moved in there. Yeah, straight after finishing, or about 6 months after finishing, and because we were exhibiting in lots of places, and we had to argue a lot about kind of what the definition of art was, because initially they didn't really consider our stuff. It was mainly for fine artists, but there's a lot of like amazing like painters and sculptors and all of them in that building. So.
Because it's got a student-y vibe.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
we're moving, so we're going to phase two of our plan. It's definitely got a student-y vibe. So we're moving to Elephant and Castle, in about a month.
Nice.
Should be less than a month, and we're doing a fit out on our new office, which is going to be like that bit in between a slick office and a student office.
Yeah, well, I think that's the perfect... Because I think you have to ask... I guess you especially, you're like... You ask yourself a lot of questions. What is Factory 15, right? So we're not a student, but we don't want to be this, like, slick office. Yeah, we want to... It's a hard balancing act, I guess.
It is, yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it's also what you can afford to actually do to the office. It was time for us to move as well, because I think when we started, again, I was saying it was like, we know we like making this sort of thing, but we don't know where we fit.
Yeah.
We spent 5 years of kind of working that out, so we know where we can get different types of work, what work's going to come in, what work that we need to push for, how we need to present ourselves a bit more in terms of the work we're chasing, but in terms of being able to invite people to our space as well. So one of the things we've got is a gallery, which we're going to kind of change... have exhibitions that are changing every like 6 weeks or so with different, you know, different artists and different curators. So it's not just going to be like Factory 15 overload. But the idea is that we keep our foot in some of the art and the design world that we kind of started from, because some of our projects, you know, the nature of a project, the bigger the project gets, the more kind of corporate sometimes it is. So trying to kind of keep within both spaces is, I think, our next challenge, but also finding a way of presenting ourselves really kind of boldly is important as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just the idea, like, because you're at your office when we went there, it's kind of, it had like ping pong table in. And
We're still keeping the ping pong table.
Good man.
That's not going. I think we're just going to have running water, which we didn't have in.
Running water, you know, like air conditioning, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, heating.
Because in the summer, I would imagine, because you had what, like 12 people, like 20 computers in a server room, and it's on like one of the top floors.
Yeah.
It must get pretty sweaty in there, I'd imagine. Yeah.
Sometimes when you're prepping for a shoot, it becomes a production office. So you might be doing, whether it's commercial or a film or something, you might have another 10 people in there. And it just by chance has happened both summers or a few summers. And there's been like all of our studio, then all of the kind of production company in there, like doing wardrobe and everything, and and then this gets a bit too much, but it's good.
So, because I remember, because when I started at Make, we started working on like office development stuff, and we did like renders, but they were more like exact representations of what they were, right? And then, so that's what I thought render houses did. Yeah. Like, you know, they're quite corporate, and then as we've kind of progressed and have gotten to what we're working together now, which I'm not going to talk about, but. We were suddenly trying to, it was much more storytelling. You know, we were trying to sell an idea as opposed to an exact representation. And then that, I just thought, because I only engage with Matt and architectural visualizations, then come to your office and see what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're doing Guinness adverts.
Yeah.
And like, and you went filming in, where was it? It was like...
Oh, this was, it was Ghana and South Africa and a bit in Kenya.
And I was like, I didn't know architectural visualization people did this. Has there always been a kind of like just a separation between you're doing full films, right? You're doing like not just animations, but they're like full live action animations, aren't they?
Yeah. I think that the way we started, me and Paul had worked freelance a lot, and John had worked freelance a lot for different. So I worked at Hamilton's, which then became BFLS, and I used a lot of kind of 3D work to kind of visualize and help with the designs and all of that sort of thing. And then when I was studying, I worked freelance for a kind of a bunch of different architects, Robin Partington, Allies and Morrison. And like I say, there was always that freelance kind of visualizer thing. So we thought, we knew that we could make money as freelancers doing that. We knew how much images were getting charged out, and we thought, well, we can do that. And that was a way of kind of also financing some of the other projects. And as a way of kind of being like, well, you know, this is something that's stable and we can do this, and it allows us to, you know, continue making these other things. So at the moment, at the start, they kind of almost started like, it was almost a bit Jekyll and Hyde. You'll be doing like very corporate things and then very, very indie films. And so what we've been trying to do is over the time is tie everything together. So our images are the kind of more impressionistic ones that you get for the different types of buildings that will, and the films as well, are kind of, again, impressionistic, or trying to kind of give audiences emotional connection to the buildings, so they're not just straight fly-throughs. But there's always been, you know, our uni work was probably as close to film as it was to architecture.
Yeah.
So there's always been that desire from me and from the other guys to kind of work in that space. So we've just, I guess it's been fairly organic, but we've just kind of gone for it, and we've just done it, worked out the best way we could by finding a steady sort of stable income.
I mean, I think it has worked really well because, you know, you're working with Brookfield. I mean, you know, that's kind of the massive developer.
The shiniest of the shiny.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, you're obviously treading that line, you know, well. And then, because I also wanted to talk about, because I remember seeing Robots of Brixton, which is your, it was kind of really well publicized. Mm. Your Bartlett, was your dissertation, your final project? Yeah. And I remember looking at it thinking, I'm crap at renders and I can't do a single still image. Yeah. And I was like, how the hell have you done a full, you know, how long did it take you to do? Like, if people haven't watched it, go and watch it.
It's like, it was about, I don't know, 6 months, 7 months. And it was quite relentless, and I lost my life to do it, but it was worth it. But I was competent at, I was good at the rendering. I wasn't as strong as, say, like Paul Nichols, who we worked with, and like I could get the results that I wanted out of it. But I knew roughly what, like in the first 6 weeks, I set out the project and said, this is going to be my, like, you know, your final blast at doing a creative project. And then I guess you just see what happens after.
Yeah.
So I was a bit possessed, and it was just, you know, you learn techniques, you kind of like, you learn how to make the image, like render for the scene as opposed to rendering a full building.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, they're like stage sets, essentially. So some of it was kind of semi-designed. So you don't necessarily kind of, you know, when you're doing your renders or your architecture, you're designing everything to the nth detail, whereas mine are kind of almost sometimes their facades. So you kind of had to learn a lot of tricks, stuff like that. But
because you had... how did you animate the robots? Did you literally animate them by hand? Like
some was hand animated, and then some is like a mix of using some motion capture data, which you find online. So it's like there's a shot where the robot gets tackled to the ground, and then I just found loads of like rugby motion capture data. So there's a dude tackling and a guy hitting. So it was just more about like timing that and getting that right, as opposed to me kind of hand animating each footstep.
I did wonder, because there's a lot of actual proper action of robots clashing into each other and stuff. But then, did you actually take video footage yourself and then, like, what's it called, rotoscoping?
That is very scary. So some bits I did when it was kind of more simple things. Some things it's like you find an approximation of what you need and maybe even adapt your scene to kind of get it to work. Because if you think of, like, Planet of the Apes or something... Mm. They have whole mocap suits, and they get Andy Serkis to go and kind of like do the whole ape acting, which is amazing. And they specifically for what they've written. Whereas there's kind of libraries online of stuff that you can get and apply to the characters that you made, and then just adapt it to kind of fit what you need, or maybe adapt what you're doing. So if you're doing, doing that project, I just had to learn how to kind of get through it. So I could have tried to animate everything, but it probably wouldn't have been as strong, and it would have taken time away from actually trying to finish it, I think.
And at the end, were you kind of, did you think, I can do anything now? Like, if I can do it, if I can do a film, then I can, that's, nothing is impossible.
It definitely gives you confidence. I think the good thing about, I think the Bartlett's got, people have mixed experiences. Ours was very, let me say mine, because I think Unit 15 was very positive for a lot of the people in our, and it gave you confidence that, like, you know, you could try something, you could try and start a company, because actually the risk is that, you know, it doesn't work, and that's not the worst thing in the world. You tried.
Yeah.
And it gives you, confidence to try something. So, after I put it out, people were saying, oh, I got lots of attention for directing. And I was like, I don't know if that's directing. I was just kind of working on this project in my room. and then suddenly it was like, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And you're like thinking, hold on a minute, I'm not sure about all of this. But you're like, well, not that much can go wrong, you know. That's basically where I see it. Not that, you know, you try something, you prep and you understand what you're aiming at, and then you just think, well, okay, if I do this and do this and do this, it should kind of work.
Yeah.
And you try and make sense of it, and
Because like when I did a uni project, you shirt your tutors.
Yeah.
About 6 people see it. Maybe at the end of the year show, 20 people come past, and then no one ever sees it again. Is it, what was it like actually, you know? It went out in the wider world and people were commenting on it and stuff, and you're like, all right, it's a personal project. And they're like, oh, it's a bit, you know, I guess it's not a controversial subject matter, but it's one that people are aware of. And
Well, I think with Nick, again, his whole ethos was like, you know, the Bartlett is a place and it's got like, you know, it's a kind of educational institution and it's an amazing place to kind of learn. And but there's life that goes on beyond that.
Yeah.
And sometimes people get stuck in this world that's the be-all and end-all. Then they finish and they're like, oh, what do I do now?
Yeah.
So he made a point of always making us all put our work online, getting it out there before. Like, so even before it was finished, it had some sort of attention and some sort of press because it had kind of been out there, all the tests had been out there. So you get used to just putting yourself out there and then not worrying about it too much. It's quite funny, when it won the silver medal was funny, like all the kind of comments and stuff on BD and people getting upset. They're like, oh, this isn't a deserved win here and all this stuff. And you're like, well, you didn't even see the other entries, so how do you know that?
You're like, stop ruining my thunder.
No, I didn't mind, but it was quite funny to see like how people, like, I knew about the silver medal and obviously knew, like, you know, I'd look at the kind of the entries from previous years and stuff, but I didn't know how, like, serious it was for lots of people. I thought it was a really cool thing, but you know, I don't know, I didn't know how, like, it offended quite a lot of people.
Yeah, but my bad.
Oh well.
Because I looked at it on, it was on DZ and reading some of the comments, they're like, it's not architecture.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, give over.
But they didn't see the whole, you know, all the work that goes, you know, towards, you see, like, the film's one thing. You know, it's kind of 5 minutes of what happened, but you didn't see, like, everything that needed to be designed for that. And I think, you know, there's a Patrick Schumacher article when he was kind of wrote a whole essay on it. And I was like, if his stuff is architecture, mine's architecture.
Zing. Down the street. That guy is mental.
all the stuff that he's doing in his studio, you know. Which I really rate as well, so I thought I was quite hurt when he was like, ooh.
You were like, oh, damn it. Because we went to a talk at, with him, and it was just when Zaha was getting quite a lot of bad press, and he just spent the entire, he'd invited the journalists who had talked against him, and a few of them were sat at the front, and he literally just spent the first hour reading what they'd written about him and then literally saying to them, you're wrong. I totally disagree. And everyone was like, oh, this is awkward. So you said you did Robots Bricks, and then you started actually, you know, going into the normal world of doing commercial architecture, I guess. And you carried on doing that in the background. And then, like, how long till you just, like, decided to sidestep and just go, do you know what, let's just do this full time? Was it like a couple of years or something before Factory 15 became
Like 3 months. So I went back to practice. Paul went on holiday. And then Jono, I can't remember what happened. So basically, like, we got a job straight away with Robin Partington and European Land. And it was a big animation and a bunch of stills. And we were like, well, we could do this. And it was also enough to kind of start the company. So, you know, I went back to practice for like 2-3 months, and Robin was very supportive, and he actually kind of put, like, the client had one condition to give us this job, was that we started working from Robin's office. So, like, Robin's got quite a slick office, everyone's got these kind of double Mac screens, and then we had all our kind of like uni computers, and there was this kind of like rabble of like 6 or 7 students like working in the back of their office, like computers blowing up. And
it's nice that they gave you that space though, right?
Yeah, so they gave us a space, and then we done the first kind of half of the job, and then once we delivered on that, they were happy for us to kind of move, and then we got our studio in Brixton. So it was only a few months until, like, less than a few months really, yeah, 3 or 4 months, and then we were kind of, yeah, it started basically.
It's just, I like, I mean, I'm just thinking, in if I put myself in your shoes, were you like, maybe it's a bit too much to do our own stuff? Or no, we can definitely do this. Like, why would we work for anyone? Was it really clear in your head? Or were you a little bit like, oh, well, let's give it 6 months? Or were you like, no, I'm all in. I'm going big.
Well, that is more, I don't know. When you design a building, you sketch out the kind of bigger principles.
Yeah.
And then you kind of work out what bits you can kind of make and design it in detail, you know, as and when. So you break it down. You don't, like... Yeah. You know, we looked at the renders and thought, the previous summer, 3 of us had done about 40 renders for Allies, and we're just like, we have to do 30 now. And we've done it last year, so we're better than we were last year, so we can do those renders. And then you have to kind of write a quote, and you're like, well, how much does that cost? And you kind of be like, well, it's going to take this long. So you just, like, it's just normal things, and you're like, well, and then you put in a spreadsheet.
Make it sound so simple. No,
I think you do think of it in those terms. You don't, you don't necessarily think about exactly what all of it means until sometimes you look back on stuff and you're like, oh, that was that. You kind of, you know.
I guess the difference is as well that, especially at the Bartlett,
yeah.
I would say that the Bartlett kind of and the AA, they're kind of the very top of the people doing rendering and stuff. And
yeah.
It was still relatively, I'm not saying it was new at that time, but it was still in its infancy. And I think you established that. I mean, 5 years ago, a render was quite a lot of money and it wasn't particularly good. Like, yeah. Compared to what you can achieve now, I think.
Yeah, but there were still, there's a lot of companies, I was like, you know, who were kind of very established. I think that there's more people starting to render in architecture schools. And actually, like, even a few of our visualizers who learned, they didn't go through architecture, they kind of went through like computer graphics and design school. Then it was like learning the software as opposed to learning the building side of it.
I wonder now, like, do you look back and think maybe I should have done an animation course? or are you, like, the architecture gave you the grounding to kind of build up, or like in hindsight, or is it just...
I think that if I'd done an animation course, I think that I would have more likely been an animator as opposed to trying to direct different projects. Because I think that, I don't know too much about the structure of the courses, but I think they tend to pipeline. So, like, you might be an animator, or you might be kind of a compositor, or you might be a visual effects artist and concentrate on, like, simulations and stuff like that. But you're more likely to be specialized. And architecture is quite broad, so you spend a lot of time talking about your ideas.
Yeah.
You know, you spend a lot of time talking about, like, society and culture and what architecture is and all of this, these sorts of things. And then you have these huge projects that you have to work on. And so you have to oversee a lot more than I think if you're doing an animation course. So then suddenly it leads you into, which is more closely linked to, I think, directing.
Yeah,
than definitely. It is to, because the only things I animate now are really like the pre-visualizations. Because that's one of the things I can get time to do. So this is when I say, okay, try and set out what we're trying to make. But I can't, you know, it's hard to sit there time-wise and kind of animate something to the level it needs to be, because the quality needs to be higher than what I could have done.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I'm like a 80% guy. I do that first 80% really quick, and then I need someone else to help help actually make it really good.
That last
20% is as time-consuming as the other bit, and I just get really bored. I'm just like, oh, come on, I just want this to be done. It's going to look good. It's just, yeah, so.
I'm glad you said that. I said, the first 80% I'm fine with, yeah. And then I'm so glad you said you just lose patience or focus, because I'm not a details person. I can't.
But some people are, so that's the thing. So if it's just working together.
And so after, because I was looking at some of the short films you've done.
Yeah.
And are they, the Jonah one?
Yeah.
Which is the one you describe what the Jonah one is before I start talking about it?
It's a film about really big fish set in Zanzibar.
Okay. Was that a commission? Was that for someone, or was that literally you just did it yourself?
So it was a commission. So it's quite an interesting story to this. So when we put out a trailer for our big kind of opening Factory 15 party, the trailer somehow kind of went to got to BBC somehow. I don't know how. One of my friends who is an author sent an email out saying my new book's out, but he didn't BCC everyone. So I was like, oh, look at all those contacts, Times, Guardian. And we were like, okay, let's just take those and then resend the trailer with all those. And, one of them happened to be someone at the BBC, and they thought, oh, okay, they were like, this is really cool. Let's do a piece on it. So then they done a piece on that, and they came to Brixton Market, and we spoke, and we said what the project's about, and there's kind of a weird, awkward interview online. but then someone from Film 4 saw it on the news, because it's on local news, or London news. And then I kind of got an email and a call the next day saying, oh, look, we can't come to the screening, but we really like to see the film. Can you send it to us? So I sent them the film, and then they asked to come in for a general meeting. So in film, lots of people have these general meetings where you go and you talk about yourself and you talk about what you want to do. And just before that, one of my best mates had been reading Old Man and the Sea, and he was like, you should do a version of this. So I went to the meeting, and I was like, they were kind of like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I haven't really directed. Lots of people are telling me that I should try and direct, and I want to do this version of Old Man and the Sea. Literally before the meeting, he said that. And they were like, oh, sounds really good. And I was like, okay. And so I kind of put a treatment together and then went back and kind of had a clearer idea of what it was. And then they kind of set me up with a producer called Ivana McKinnon and a writer called Jack Thorne, who's just, someone's in the press about him yesterday. And he wrote This Is England with Shane Meadows, and it was like this kind of quite big scary team, and then it was like, okay, cool, let's go and work on this project. So it took a while to kind of work it out, and it took a while for me to become comfortable with working like that.
So Film 4 were like investing in new talent?
Yeah, so they invested in talent to kind of people they think can kind of make feature films but need help with other things. So it was all well and good me directing something for an architecture course in my bedroom, but I needed to show if someone's going to trust you with money to make a feature film, you need to show that you can work with actors, you need to show that you can work with a crew, you need to show you can kind of put a story together and it kind of semi makes sense.
So I guess most people would then choose maybe a location that was easy to get to but you chose Zanzibar.
Yeah.
And there's filming in boats and it's just sounds about as challenging as you can make a first film for a short film.
I didn't think about it too much. That's what I said. You kind of be like, because I was like, well, I made that with nothing, so someone's going to give me some money so I can make the whole world. but also it's like, you're trying to be like, what do you want to see and what do you want to make? And, kind of trying to be bold with your choices, because I was thinking, well, you don't get lots of opportunities like this, so try and make it stick or make it count.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just to be difficult or to be kind of ambitious. It was like, I actually thought when my friend said, okay, you can make that, I was like, well, actually where I'd like to see that is here. And then I got kind of a vision for the film. So it was like, well, why not? Because there were lots of times that kind of I could have veered off to kind of make it easier, and maybe I should have at some points, but at the time, you're naive, you kind of try things that...
Were they like a bit like, Kidboy, do you want to try maybe the Thames, like film at the Thames maybe? And they're like,
not really, because that's what they wanted to see, you know. They wanted, that's what they kind of, you know, I guess they bought into it and it finished.
So, and then what do you do with the film then? Do they then present it on Film 4? Is there like an industry gathering that they present it at?
So we done a massive party in Village Underground where we had a big kind of screen and projector and bands and stuff and a free bar for a bit.
Yeah, 20 seconds.
Yeah. And the idea was just to get it out there and kind of for people to see it. So you go to, we went to like Sundance and a lot of festivals, Sundance, I think South by Southwest. I went to like, I think it's been to about 100 festivals, been to lots of festivals. And the idea was to release it online and kind of get people to see it and I guess try and get more work and try and kind of move into doing long form stuff.
That sounds like an incredible opportunity, Film 4. It is kind of, because it's got such a professional feel to it that it's like, so was that your first, your first kind of film that you made? Not bad. Good job.
But it was like a lot, it took a long time. It was like about a year and a bit and it was a lot, you know, you're trying everything for the first time and you're working out how that works and everything's, you know, you're like, is that really going to work? Or, you know, you're sitting there in script meetings and you don't really understand how to dissect a script because you never really read one.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And also, I always like the idea of our meetings here are about like doors and windows and waterproofing details, but your meetings would be like, right, I want the fish and I want it like the scales to slap is just like, I want that, like,
that's what it means, like, noise. No. The stranger ones are the ones we have to talk about the emotions. And like, it's fine when it's a person, but when you're like, you have to talk about the emotions of like, there's a lady called Tessa Ross who used to be the head of Film 4 at the time. We still work together now, but I remember a meeting of her and a couple of other executives and we were talking about the emotions of the fish. And you're thinking, this is a big as that, because it was 2011, I think they'd done Slumdog Millionaire a couple of years ago. And then we're talking about the emotions of what the fish is feeling and why he's doing, what the motivations are. And you're like, okay, yeah, cool.
I love you get heating on. No, he's definitely sad. He's sad. Yeah. No, he's happy. Think about it. He's leaping out the water. He's happy.
Yeah.
And then so off the back of that, did you get instantly, or you're like, right, I've made it now, I'm with Film 4, this is going to be amazing. And then, like, did you get other work from it, or were you like,
I don't know if the words made it. I don't know, you should ask Ken if he's made it and see what he says. Did you ask him that?
Well, no, not as such.
I bet it's like, everything you just hope that you get something else from.
Yeah.
So straight away, that done quite well, everyone was really excited, but they don't really know where to place you because it's quite random, the film. So it's like, you know, it's not like I'm going to get an episode of Casualty from it, or
who, the fish guy?
Yeah, they're like, and then you kind of like, you get a few Hollywood scripts. There's one script I got which was like about a guy that is hunting a really big fish in a like robot suit. So it's like someone had literally seen the robot film and thought, okay, this makes sense.
I love it. So you've been typecast as robot fish guy.
Yeah. that didn't go anywhere, but it wasn't very good.
So you're actually getting scripts and stuff.
So you get sent scripts, but you know, sometimes they might be for development or to work on. So, you know, it doesn't really mean they're like ready to go. It just means that someone wrote this once and they're trying to kind of like kickstart it.
Yeah. Do you want to work on your own scripts more than other people's scripts?
But there's not loads and loads of good scripts about. So, you know, the best scripts will just go to the kind of top directors, really. So you have to kind of find a book or something that's really interesting or kind of start a scratch. So from that point, you know, I was like, let me finish Jonah and then I'll think about what projects to kind of do. And then there was a period where I was working a lot with Film 4 to develop some new ideas, which we kind of started doing. And then they're kind of still in the kind of writing process now. What came from it? There was a Katy Perry music video that kind of started, and we got on set and we're about to film. And then she didn't release the track, so there's no point in making the video.
Oh, man.
So then there's about a year and a bit of like full starts.
Just going back to the Katy Perry video. So when you're writing the script for a music video,
yes,
were you thinking, okay, right, well, what can I do with Katy Perry that would be interesting? I think she needs to be in a swimming pool, and they'd be like, or I just
yeah,
directing,
it's basically like that.
Yeah, I need more. Get more of her in the frame.
No, they have an idea of what they want, roughly, and then they want you to pitch on it. So you have to pitch against a bunch of other directors. And it was quite, this process was quite long, this pitching process, because I think I had done the short and done two shorts, and there was quite a lot of experienced people I was up against. But they liked the treatment. But they're obviously nervous because he's like, well, can he actually do it? Can he do what he's saying he's going to do? But we didn't ever get to find out, really, because we got on set, we were there in LA. We'd done some kind of dance rehearsals, we'd done all this stuff, but then she wasn't releasing the track, so then everything kind of just collapsed. It was a bit disappointing.
Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And so then what was the next thing after that, then?
So next thing after that was... What happened after that? Then there was a bit of a gap. Again, like a lot of full starts, a lot of pitching on stuff. In the middle of 2014, I shot another short, which I said I wasn't going to do, but then, you know, you never know when opportunities are going to come up, with Jack O'Connell and Holiday Grainger, which we're finishing this year, because it's kind of, shorts have no financial, other than kind of investment in talent, there's no reason why they exist. Right? Yeah. No one pays to see them, like maybe a few people at festivals, but yeah, they're important for people to try. So,
how did you get Jack O'Connell in a short? Then is he like a friend or something?
Well, Daniel, who Daniel Kaluuya done Jonah with, was with him on Skins, and I just said, look, and we were talking, and he said, oh, Jack would be good for that, and then we approached Jack formally, but Daniel also just texted him and said, look, it's worth doing because, like, you know, it's not going to be your average short, it's going to be quite different, same as, so then he was like on board, and also I think he wanted to go to a festival.
That was it, you filmed it at a festival?
Yeah,
it's
a music festival.
Nice.
And he's a scarecrow, so for anyone who loves him, they're not gonna see his face, he looks like a scarecrow.
So you get someone who's like,
he'd just finished those.
Did he go, oh, wicked, yeah, I want to go to festival. Right, yeah, we're going to hide your face. Oh, what?
No, but he knew he was a scarecrow, so it was fine. And the story's about, it's just that he's a really good actor, so it was like, well, I want a really good actor. So, you know, loads of people were like, yeah, but you're covering his face. I was like, yeah, but it's about a scarecrow, it's not about Jack. Jack is the scarecrow.
And then, so what, are you using, like, you're then animating scarecrow's face based on his facial movements?
Yeah.
I hope you do it justice.
Yeah,
you
exactly,
like,
yeah. Hope he likes it. So that shot, and then I done a commercial. Then I done my first commercial for a bank, an ethical bank, which was quite a long process. And it was about a tree. It was like a short film bank advert.
Is this the one with the spinning camera that goes around? And it's all these bits that like open and close and stuff. Was that a different? No, okay.
I don't know what that is.
Thinking a different one.
It's called The Seed and the Moon, and it's about this kind of little seed trying to grow towards the moon, but by doing so, transforming this like dark, evil city into a lovely place. But and that was all kind of, we technically, that was quite a challenge because we wanted to do it in time lapse, but everything's animated, so we had to like scan lots of locations, and it was a kind of really kind of a techie, you had to kind of guess a lot, and I found sometimes I found that a bit frustrating.
Because that's like, I remember watching seeing Transformers, and you have an idea of how a Transformer transformed, but actually when you watch it, you're like, how does that become a transformer? Like, and actually an animator's got to go through every single frame. I was like,
and they've got to trick you as well.
Yeah, and I'm like, it's actually, that's ridiculously hard to do, right? It's like, to guess the bits in between, you know, like something exploding, you're like, I don't, everyone knows what an explosion feels like, but no one has any idea what it, like, in time lapse, like.
Yeah, so that was, it's quite technical, that job. And then straight after that, I'd done the Guinness ad last year, end of last year, which came out beginning of this year, or came out last week.
Where was that filmed again? That was...
The Guinness ad?
Yeah.
Ghana and South Africa.
Because you've got loads of, like, kid dancing in it and stuff. It's wicked. There's people dancing in it.
Yeah.
And this was, like, what... because you're filming it on what looks like very like on location.
Yeah.
Is it like, how did you know to go there? Like, why there?
Well, it's for Guinness Africa. So
Guinness Africa.
Yeah. So Guinness, about 50% of the revenue is kind of turnover comes from Africa.
Guinness?
Yes.
In a hot country?
Yeah. And it's really kind of like lukewarm and like heavy. So they've got a new drink, which is a bit less heavy, and it's kind of aimed at a younger audience and a more mixed audience. What do you call?
Yeah,
consumers.
Consumers, yeah. I can't think of anything worse than a warm Guinness.
Like Nigeria, they love it. So it's like, you know, way more than England, people drink Guinness. Like if you think they've got 200, like 180 million people there as well.
Yeah. A warm Guinness. Wow.
Which is about 7.5%.
All right, proper stuff then.
Yeah.
So, and then you're filming, how long did that take? Because it's a wicked advert, like, to have all those, like, people dancing.
Yeah, that the shoot was about, it was a 5-day shoot. We actually, on set, but I was there for, like, maybe 2.5 weeks. And, yeah, 2 different countries. But there's a lot of prep before, like, loads of the cast flew in from all over the continent. Lots of kind of planning, prep, like location work. So like it's not, you don't, you know, behind the camera, but so behind that person dancing, there's probably about 40 people staring at them. So it's like you can't just like show up.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to do loads of work, kind of getting your location signed off, finding locations that you can shoot in different directions that make it feel like lots of different places.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Because you don't want to move so many people all the time.
You don't even think about the logistics of filming until someone says it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I can imagine.
Some people do. That's their job and they're really good at it.
That must help massively, yeah. Doesn't it? Right? Like, because
yeah.
I guess with... I always think when you're doing Robots of Brixton on your own,
yeah,
you can...
It's just it's a decision of how much you think personally you can get done in the before the deadline. And it's like you'll be like, I either have to make that shot better or I have to leave that one incomplete. So that's why there's so many mistakes in it. But it's like I could either fix that mistake or I wouldn't have finished it. So
yeah. But also, like, you have to, on your own, you have to keep your own momentum up, right? You have to keep your own enthusiasm. Or if you make a mistake and you think, oh, I've got to go back a few steps to go forward, that's fine on your own. But then suddenly when you've got 40 people there, and they're like, right, go again, everyone's like, oh. Like, keeping the momentum up must be quite hard. Like,
but you get a lot of help. So you have a first AD who's, like, the person, like, and depending on your personality, is also depending who you get as your first. So, so the first is the one that shouts at everyone and gets everyone ready, because if imagine that many people, and I've been on other bigger sets, and you know, say you've got 100 people that you need to kind of move or keep in time, you know, there's a person that basically kind of shouts and screams and tells people off, and you know, and even if you want to tell him off, you just say, oh, like, come on, we need to hurry everyone up. You have a little whisper in his ear, and then he goes and screams at everyone, and he looks like the bad guy. But it was really you that was, like, mad.
And you're like, God, that guy, eh?
Yeah.
Such a twat. Yeah.
So, well, that's their job, and,
Because also, like, you're making me realise that maybe, like, 10 minutes of film footage... you're just looking at the tip of the iceberg, the amount of work that goes into just getting that, like, little bit of footage, you know, every day. I remember hearing, like, some film did, like, a minute a day, and I was like, what? And then, but it's a massive film, and you just realise how complicated it is to get everything perfectly.
Yeah.
And especially dancing, were you like, guys, that was a bit crap?
Or not really.
Were they
that was
it?
Easier. We were actually, once we had started shooting, we were faster, because... It was like the pre-production was quite stressful, and then we either flew people or we cast flew people from whichever African country it was they're from, or cast in South Africa. But we also, everyone had done rehearsals and they knew what they were doing, and also we picked them, like, because of they'd done a specific type of dance, or because we had seen their YouTube channel or something like that. So, like. It was really them just coming up and filming them, and I just had to put the camera in the right location, which also someone else is doing for you. So, like, you just have to, like, hopefully the set should... So, actually, when we were, you know, we could have cut that ad in, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 different ways. We had lots of good stuff.
And did you have, like, really loud speakers to try and, like, get them, like, you know, get the energy up as high as possible?
Yeah, we did.
Nice. Because I always think, like... You know, you see films and you realise actually the scene they did was in total silence in a club, but they, like, pretended it.
But we didn't know talking, so that's the thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's another thing, because this is a nice, amazing room, but imagine if you're, you know, you need it clear for when you're having a conversation in a nightclub, and then the actors have to like pretend that they're shouting,
yeah,
but they're not really shouting because there's no music there, but they have to get, you have to get that voice across, and then you put the music in after, because so, otherwise the track will be, the background track will be at different points every time you're cutting.
I remember seeing, like, is it called additional dialogue recording?
ADR, yeah.
ADR, where like they have to, this really emotional scene, and then saw them like in a sound booth, like we are now, like, like just
remouthing it, and they have to try and get in the same like moment, and then they're watching the screen, and they have to try and match sync their lips. Like, actors are amazing. Like, what, there's some, like, I know that not all actors, but you know, some of the stuff they have to do when you, like, most people just feel like they're being ridiculous,
yeah,
but like you'd have to really kind of get themselves into a place. And also, like, loads of things like body control, facial control, and yeah, like, stuff that, like, yeah.
And also, you must be like, right, I liked the first way you did it, but can you do this on the next one? They have to remember, like, a minute of, like,
yeah,
fairly intricate movements, right?
Sometimes, yeah.
So, you've done your short films, and they're going brilliantly. Do you want to do a film?
Yeah, so the plan is to do a proper film that goes in the cinemas or on telly or something. But it's just which one. So I've got different ones in development, and there's potentially some TV things I might be doing later this year. But it's just at the moment it's quite weird, because even though you've got loads of stuff, you're still sitting there like in between jobs. You're like,
yeah. So what can you tell us anything about?
There's a couple. There's a film I've got, two films I've got worked with film for. One which is kind of set in a near future London, which is really about kind of housing and the lack of housing, and it's about this kind of big squatter community that are forced to squat in this like old derelict building, and then their kind of house comes under attack, and they do like things to kind of try and save it, and they're not always the most savory people, so it's a bit just kind of there's it's a bit like Robots, where there's kind of hints on looking at our society today, but trying to do that in like a way that is entertaining and is engaging. And then I've got a film which is about 1950s London and about the first kind of generation of Caribbean immigrants. And it's kind of a magical realist thing, and it's the main character's has these kind of visions or something, and we kind of explore that. So it's kind of sci-fi, but it's like a past sci-fi, if that's a thing.
So you've always kept an eye on, because that still sounds like in a similar vein to Robots.
Yeah.
It's like it still feels part of that kind of world.
Yeah.
It's not like you've gone, right, I'm now going to do a rom-com. You know, like,
yeah,
are you very conscious of like still sticking to the original things that kind of got you interested, and you know, that's still very clear in your mind?
The thing about Robots is very like a pure like expression of what I wanted to look at and what I felt was interesting. And I think even with something like Jonah, there's bits I found that were very interesting that I wanted to talk about, but they still weren't as connected to kind of, you know, it's almost like Robots was like the first thing, and it's like, for me, I would like to go back to that kind of territory.
Yeah.
You know, because other things, you know, if you get commissioned to do something, it's, or hired to do something, it's kind of you working out how to kind of, you know, the Guinness advert is me working out how I would do that.
Yeah.
Advert, whereas kind of trying to kind of over the years like get all the tools I need to kind of almost like advance kind of the things I want to say.
Yeah.
Because I still think Robots is my like most like provocative and potent film.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so. There's something like, so I feel like it'll be fitting for my first feature to kind of be of the same, in the same vein. And the idea that it's still entertaining and cool to watch, but it's there is the kind of meaningful message underneath and within it.
And are you? Does that mean writing your own scripts and stuff then? Is that something you're doing?
Kind of. Not really. Well, I work closely with writers, which is probably annoying for them sometimes, because they probably just want me to go away. But
yeah, wait, go away, let me write the script.
Yeah, just let me finish it. So like I tend to work very much on like the concept and the world and some of the bigger things that are happening, and then they might go away, and because you know I've never written dialogue, but the more I kind of work on story and stuff, the more I start to feel more confident, and the more like in the future it'd be cool to kind of start writing stuff.
Because I guess that, like, the way you're describing the script writing is actually a lot more complicated than I realised, because I was like, why just write yourself? I mean, you've done short films, you've done rope, just write yourself. But it's actually, I guess, the...
Just people have to talk to each other and say things to each other. And that's a big kind of, like, drive, a narrative drive, and something needs to happen at the beginning and at the end.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And do you, I guess as well, like... The 10-minute short that you did, you said took you a year. Or, like, some of them have taken a year to do, like, 10, 20-minute shorts and stuff. Mm. Doing, like, a full feature-length film, but that sounds like an intense... Or is it just the same work?
It's more work, but it's kind of the same thing. You basically go for a development stage, which will take you roughly the same... longer on a feature film, but it's still... It's not like, because it's only 10 minutes, it's going to take you one-tenth of the time.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that, because you still have to get your concept, your characters, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And actually, like, sometimes you're like, well... And the thing that you don't have with short films is because there's no commercial output for them. You don't have... You might have some funding to do them, but you don't have kind of close to what it should actually cost. You know, you kind of have to... So then it always has to fit around everything else for everyone else. So it's like... People will love to get involved and, like, work for nothing and all those sorts of things, but they've also got to, like, eat, so they'll do it, but it'll have to kind of be and fit within people's structure. So lots of things take a bit longer on a short film than they would if you actually could just pay people to do their job.
But you can't. Do you get points where you're a little bit like, what am I going on about? You know, like, is this a good idea? Do you just think... I just got to remember what I thought at the beginning.
Yeah, no, you do. You get lost in it sometimes, especially projects that have been going on a while. You're like, okay, what is this about? And then you know, because basically you same as designing, you start with probably a really clear idea. Then you like spend ages like making your idea a bit crap and overcomplicating it.
Yeah.
Then you're like, why do I keep those ideas? But then going through that process of overcomplicating it, there's like little shades of something or little things that are really interesting that actually make your original idea richer, but you just have to go through this full cycle on it.
So you would say there's a painful stage of every single project. There's no point fighting it.
It's just like the middle of everything. The middle of your holiday, you go away, everything's great, and then the middle, you have an argument with your missus, and then the end's great again.
So, and then you just like charge on forward, assuming that it'll be great, it'll be fine. Have you had projects that have just taken a total turn halfway through?
Yeah. What, and then what, being not unrecoverable?
No, just from what your original idea, you're like, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, they change. They change all the time. But there's still always something in the original, you know, thing that you set out to do that you might have set out to kind of tonally, you might hit the same tone, but the actual what happens in it might be completely different.
So kind of, is this, when you're saying directing, are you still talking like, special effects and animation or that kind of the combination of the two, or is this just straight, you know, you want to do like just an actual film with no special effects in, or are you always drawn to the
able to like change environments and things like that? So you know, most films have some sort of visual effects in them, even like the things that you don't even think have visual effects in them. It just depends to what level, and I guess some of my films are quite heavily visible, but it's also depends on, that's expensive as well, so it depends on, you know, part of what's been hard is trying to find a film that isn't mega expensive that has that in, you know, because it's not like a straight live action film is cheaper. So like when I say directing, it's directing the piece of work you're doing.
Yeah.
So like creatively just being the lead on it, what that means.
If you did your own feature film, would this be doing all the special effects in-house in Factory 15?
It depends. It depends on what the scale is. Like it depends on how many shots and what type of things. Like what we try and do is, I try and involve the studio in as many projects as you can, as I can. And sometimes you can't always. It's tricky because sometimes, you know, I might be hired as a director and then they've already got their team that they want to use. And then it's like, I'm stepping on toes to get it done, but I don't mind that too much, stepping on toes. But it just depends. And also depends on what the best result, because, for example, if we were to do a feature film, like we're 12 people, but like, you know, the big studio have thousands of people, so we like to be involved in like the design stage, and then there's sometimes it's like, okay, well cool, we've actually got this 100 shots to do or 200 shots to do. It might be better if someone with a better pipeline and who can kind of churn through that more efficiently.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine, I remember watching Avatar. I know that's one very extreme version of it, but just thinking, how? Like, I can't even do a render of a building, like a dumb box, and they're doing trees and animals and everything. So, but
yeah,
I guess
it cost about £300 million or something.
I will admit their budget was a little bit bigger. So I wanted to also ask, because we're coming up to the hour mark, so I'll start wrapping this up, but I wanted to ask you about Unreal, like the game engine, because... Yeah. Kind of coming full circle, that was one of the original reasons we came to your office to kind of to ask you about Unreal, was because it does feel like there's kind of a convergence of computer game technology, kind of film effects, and we're using it to do architectural renderings now, and I guess to a point you could model in it. I think it's probably clunky to do that, but using VR and Unreal, it was just mind-blowing when we did it here in a very basic form. Is that something you guys are trying to really push as well? Because you won an award, didn't you, last week there?
Yeah, so last year there was a competition because Unreal have kind of got this software and this engine, and they need more content. The same with anything for VR. Like, people haven't... It's almost like the tech's ahead of, like, the content. Mm-hmm. So they kind of ran this competition for people to design and kind of make a VR experience. So... we entered to design a vineyard. So we designed this kind of vineyard with these weird drones that pick these grapes from these kind of like volcanic pockets.
Yeah, it's such a good idea.
It was a vineyard that was based on all the actual kind of the landscape. And so we kind of set that up, and we just saw it as a chance to kind of actually get into it and, you know, try like doing a project in real time with VR, how you could actually package it. And so what we want to do now, we want to try and like work with an architect to kind of on a real project, you know, and see how that could actually fit into the life scale of like an actual design project and how that could be useful. And it was just finding the right type of project and the right architect to kind of to work that out, because, you know, it's not just representation. And if you want it for just representation, I guess.
Oh, you just mean like just doing like real life, just like a real life render. You're saying it should be more than that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, how can you use that to define what you're building and what you're designing, and how is it something that you could kind of plug into a series of stages over a few years? You know, could you use it at competition stage and then basically keep re-updating the model until you're going to the marketing stage? I don't know. We haven't quite worked out how it fits in. We're keen to do that because now we know how to use it. It's just where it gets used and how it gets consumed.
And for your film stuff, is Unreal and VR have any influence on the kind of filming stuff?
Not my stuff. Not my stuff personally, as me directing.
Is it something you want to do?
I'm not sure in the film space. I think in games it's amazing. I played on the Sony, the Morpheus, and I think there's going to be like a hybrid game type film, where you're a character within a film and it's quite cinematic, and you're maybe working something out, and you can maybe talk to people, you can maybe explore new spaces, but it'll still be a bridge between a game and a film, which is, you know, maybe. But I don't think the kind of like going into a certain like VR hole in the middle of a normal film is the right approach.
It does.
There's lots of people talking about it, and they say things like immersive experience. They say, and people don't quite know what they mean yet when they say that. Everyone's still working it out. But I guess my films in particular, I think I'd like to focus on like culture and society, and if it makes it better by having that as VR, maybe. But if it's kind of gimmicky, I'd prefer just to kind of do a project where it's actually more meaningful to use it.
And I guess the channels for you to get a film out through YouTube, Vimeo, they're limitless, right? They're worldwide, expansive reaches, whereas VR is such a niche at the moment, isn't it?
It is niche, but the thing is, again, it's like all the companies invested loads in the tech, you know, to make sure that people aren't sick or to kind of make sure that the refresh rates are amazing, all of that. There's not loads and loads of content. So even though it is fairly niche, actually, like lots of companies are throwing money at making stuff for it because they need, you know, they spent like billions on this headset and like, everyone's got, okay, now what do I do?
Because, I mean, It does seem like a unique opportunity. It does seem like the first person to work out an advert that is really viral with VR, well, it'll get so copied so quickly because people are like, oh, finally, now we know what the hell to do with it. Because at the moment, any idea, it's kind of like a...
But I don't think you need to be the first person. It's like, you know, before the iPod, there were plenty of MP3 players.
Yeah, true.
You know? Yeah. It's just how you actually craft it to make it the best it can be, which will take time, yeah. I guess.
So you guys are experimenting yeah. Oculus Rift, and yeah. which one do you think is going to win out then? I'm fascinated with VR.
I don't know. You need to talk a bit more to Paul about VR. He knows a lot more. I like the HoloLens because it's AR. I think Oculus is cool, and I think there's the different things like the Google. There's like each basically phone's got its own system. I think Oculus is really cool. But again, for me, like I've seen a few things that I think are really interesting, but I still haven't like, you know, for me, it's like between the headsets, it's like saying, okay, you know, what's better, an Apple or a Samsung? And they kind of do basically the same thing.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. I mean,
loads of people will tell me, no, they're not, they're completely different. But like, you know, Apple's got a button, Samsung doesn't have a button.
Yeah, like, so they're totally
essentially
different.
They do WhatsApp.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. WhatsApp, Spotify, that's all everyone uses. So we'll wrap this up now. And thanks for doing this. But so what is next for Factory 15 then? The big office move, I guess.
So we've got the big office move. Again, there might be this telly thing which you might be involved in. We've got the gallery as part of the office move. And there's a couple of, like, we don't know exactly what our next big project's going to be.
Okay.
But it's going to be good.
I don't want to give it away, but it's going to be amazing. All right, brilliant. Thank you so much, Kidboy.
That was
brilliant. Thanks.
Well, there you go. That was episode 19 with Kidboy from Factory 15. If you haven't watched the short films yet, go on. They're really good. After the podcast, Factory 15, along with one of the other co-founders, Paul, they came and did a presentation to the whole of Make, the whole office. It was really, really cool to see, because we have this massive, like 70-inch high definition telly at the front with a really good sound system. And it was really fun getting the office to kind of watch what I think are absolutely stunning videos, and played loud and proud, you know, as they should be displayed, not on a little computer screen with no music. And the quality is just unbelievable. I mean, they're just, as I said, they're moving to new offices in Elephant and Castle in about a month, I think. And you just get the feeling that this is just the beginning for them. So hopefully in a year's time, can interview them again, find out what they're up to. So if some of these scripts that he's been working on work out, who knows what's next. I hope you enjoyed that. Tweet me or subscribe if you want to keep hearing these. And our next Fortnite's podcast, I either have a podcast with Will Nash, who is he's worked with the BBC and he's director, and he's directed short films and he's directed music videos, and he's just starting out as well. So obviously love the idea of being director, and I really want to find out more how to do it, have a good movie nerd chat as well. Or depending on who responds quickest to my email, it'll be Johnny Collis, who is he runs the Camden Comedy Room, and he's a stand-up comedian, improv comedian, I think, and also runs an amazing podcast called Version 3.0. It's brilliant. It's actually probably one of my favourite podcasts now, I think, because it's all about turning 30 and, questioning the things in your life. And he's done 4 really good podcasts, or 5 now, and it's him and his 2 friends. And I think they all run the podcast network, and that's why I need to find out more, because they've cryptically not let on who is in the podcast and who presents it, and I kind of worked it out myself. But that's podcast gold to me. It's a comedian who does his own podcast as well. So that'll be really fun. That we're actually going to record that at his studio in the Camden Comedy Room, because they have their own podcast network and they have a room specifically set up to record podcasts. So it'll be one of those two. And then after that, I also have Indy Doha, who is the founder of 00 Architects, and I realised that I've interviewed four people from 00, all separately without me realising. That's Jay Un, who is now Studio Weave, is now kind of under the umbrella of 00. So I interviewed him in episode 3, and then episode 5 or 6 was with complete mind blank. He did Wiki House. He also works at 00 and founded Wiki House, and then OpenDesk is also under Indies 00. So I thought probably should go to the source, and he said, "Yeah, he said absolutely fine. Sit down and do the interview." So yes, you've got three more, and then that's the end of series 2. While I work out what to do next. So I've actually been given the email address for the producer or the program director of Radio 2. So one, she'd be really interesting to interview anyway. But two, it would be amazing to, you know, create more upper level. The idea of doing a radio show fills me with joy. I think that would be so much fun. I've got... we're rebranding, so we've got we're having the logo redone by Sam, and hopefully she'll have the website all up and running by the end of the series, so when we start series 3 we can hit the ground running. But yeah, it's I've big ambitions for us, so I hope you enjoy them, and yes, I will shut up now. Bye bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.